We regularly hear demands to decolonize everything from academics' curricula to hairstyles to art exhibitions. We hear laments about cultural appropriation. At the same time, we hear complaints about the lack of representation of certain identity groups, for example, in the arts. We hear that only white people can be racist and that they always are so by default. Politicians, actors and artists pride themselves on being woke. Helen Pluckrose, what has happened to society?
I think we've gone into a kind of new stage of activism, which was initially intended to carry on the good work of the civil rights movements and to address remaining attitudes, biases and discourses, ways of talking about things. This is the steel man position. You know, people wanted to keep addressing existing racism, sexism. When laws changed and, you know, it sort of legal equality had been achieved, racism didn't just go away. But what's happened is that in the late 80s, 90s, academics have just, they all kind of rose up at once and they took their ideas from postmodernism. Mm-hmm. So it's coming from this concept of knowledge as a product of language, which is legitimated by the powerful. And so it's almost a conspiracy theory, a very simplistic, it's got more and more simplistic. And now we're always understanding everything in power dynamics. Right. So there's always a power imbalance. And the work of the scholar or the activist is to uncover it. So this underlies the whole thing with decolonization. If a white person has dreadlocks or something, this is wrong because black people have been undervalued before and their hair has been a target of racism. So the power dynamic goes in the wrong way for a white person to take a hairstyle which is more commonly associated with black hair. But it doesn't work the other way around because that power dynamic isn't there. So this is quite counterintuitive to a lot of people.
Right. You already mentioned it. I mean, a fundamental point in your book is a critique of postmodernism. So I would like to ask you, why is postmodernism so problematic and responsible for what we experience today?
It is that cluster of ideas, the cluster of ideas about how knowledge is constructed and how power works and the need to read power into everything. So postmodernism at its root, it was described as a skepticism towards meta-narratives. So that sounds quite positive. That's looking at big, overarching, simplistic narratives and being skeptical of them. Skepticism is a good thing. But in cynical theories, we argue that this has turned into, and it was always, I think, with the postmodernists, turned into cynicism. The idea that everything is about power. It's always about dominant groups oppressing other groups. We've always got to unpick everything, look for the least, there's the sort of worst possible motivation for everything in relation to these power dynamics, and it's created a really sort of toxic mess of theory.
So if I understand you correctly, you also define or think of postmodernism, or you call it like a form of radical relativism, right?
Yeah, radical skepticism.
Or skepticism.
And, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, yes, relativism, but it gets quite complicated and contradictory on relativism when we get into the theories.
And this leads to a form of cynicism, right?
Yes, this is what we have argued. So we will say that skepticism is good. You know, the modern period particularly was defined by skepticism of the meta-narratives that had dominated before, you know, patriarchy, feudalism, theocracy, all of these big ideas about how society was meant to work. So skepticism of these is good, but skepticism asks, how do we know this is true? And it is still looking to discover what is true. With the postmodernists, it's turned around to, we cannot know that anything is true. And what is interesting and important is whose power is served here, whose needs, whose interests. So that leads to the most cynical reading of almost any situation you can imagine.
Right. But for example, people on the side of postmodernism would argue that the potential of postmodern theory lies precisely in the unrelenting dynamism of its criticism, the aim at processes of delimitation, of contradiction, of the constitution of meaning. Why is this a bad thing?
because of how it works in practice. Mm-hmm. I think the whole idea of questioning and picking things apart can be important and can be valid, but there are better ways to do it than a kind of radical skepticism, which really despairs of ever finding any truth. If you're dismantling everything and just sort of leaving it in a mess on the floor, then there isn't much that can be done with this. And that is, in fact, precisely what the second wave of scholars said in the late 1980s, when they said it was essentially destructive and it needed, while a lot of its insights were good, it needed to be made actionable and useful.
Right.
I think they were wrong.
Okay. But you work with two principles, among many others. But one is the postmodern knowledge principle, you know, that consists of the radical skepticism about objective knowledge or truth. So in the end, it's a power game, right? So who defines what is truth and who has like a certain strategic means behind it too, right?
Yeah, so when we're looking at language, there isn't any group on the left or on the right who doesn't think that language is powerful and that language can is how culture is perpetuated. The difference is in how we respond to that. Mm-hmm. So the Marxists, for example, they believed that power pressed downwards, and so they wanted to raise consciousness with philosophy of the working class. And then the religious conservatives, particularly, their fear was of heresy and blasphemy, so they recognized that language was powerful. For liberals, I think the most positive attitude towards the power of language has been created, and this is that we can use it to our advantage if we have viewpoint diversity, if we have people arguing with each other, raising their ideas. Everybody is allowed to say everything. Everybody is allowed to criticize everything. And this is how knowledge advances, and this is how moral progress is made, not, you know, speedily and in straight lines. There's errors, there's lapses. But this has been the best system, rather than any of those which have attempted to control language and reroute its power.
Right. It sounds so reasonable to me when you describe this kind of like marketplace of ideas. You know, why are people so allergic against it? Or some people?
There's a good criticism to be made, which is that a marketplace of ideas could end up just reinforcing the status quo. It could be the might of the majority. Mm-hmm. But I think that evidence shows, that history shows, that this isn't actually what has happened. As societies have become more tolerant of heretical views being expressed, those ideas have been able to spread. We now have a much more open, well, we don't right now, we're going in the wrong direction. But, you know, at the end of the last century, the beginning of this one, we were in a position where people really could criticize anything without being considered immoral, without being prosecuted, without being fired, you know, with some exceptions. You wouldn't want to be advocating paedophilia if you worked in a school or something. But, you know, political positions were able to be said, atheist positions, religious positions, philosophical positions. So that has worked well. But if we look at other cultures where, and, you know, our own culture in the past, where one narrative has been insisted upon, for example, when it was illegal, criminal, not to be Christian or to be the wrong kind of Christian, mm-hmm. this was much more of a might of the majority. Even though it was enforced from above, when people began to be able to say, I'm not sure I believe that, at the Reformation, I have the right to interpret this for myself, and then I have the right to believe that this isn't true at all. This is when we have seen a greater progress towards the things that I would argue that we need to be progressing towards: scientific advance, gender equality, racial equality, LGBT equality.
And you mentioned language as also plays an important part, you know, in this kind of postmodern concept and social activism. So many activists actually believe that by changing the way we talk about things, knowledge can be changed and power structures toppled. Is there actually evidence that by changing the way we speak about things, for example, we gender things or whatever, the reality around these things will change?
I think that gets things the wrong way around. Mm-hmm. I think language changes as ideas change, and ideas need to change by discussing the various merits of them.
Okay.
So an example I give is that I worked with elderly people before I started studying, and I saw the term lady doctor. So that was what the elderly people said. As we're getting towards the end, nobody anymore says lady doctor. And this reflects that it isn't unusual to see a woman doctor. A lady doctor isn't anything different to a doctor. So we can see how ideas have changed, and then it's reflected in language. If you tried to do it the other way round and ask people, or really problematize, I think you can ask people, please don't use that term. It implies this and it makes me feel a certain way. That's something that can be talked about. But if we are trying to sort of force people to use certain terminology in relation to gender in particular, that's one of the ones that's particularly policed. If we're understanding the idea of microaggressions and it all working in this big system of power. So the elderly ladies I was talking about, they weren't trying to perpetuate a power dynamic in which women couldn't be doctors. You know, so it's a very sort of backwards system, I think.
So basically, what I hear between the lines, you advocate for natural change and not forced change, basically.
Yeah, and also that, you know, that we need to be able to pick our own language to be able to discuss our own ideas. I've been arguing over the last few days with gender critical feminists who sometimes I'm allied with because they are critical of the authoritarian trans activism, which stems from queer theory. But they are also not very happy with the way that I use language. If I choose to speak to address a trans person with the pronouns they prefer, they feel this is morally wrong and it's perpetuating a kind of stereotypical system and erasing the biological nature of womanhood. So yes, we get those kind of ideas, and I think that they are quite intuitive to us, whereas the postmodernists often claim that we are going around in a haze of common sense and they need to tell us about how everything is socially constructed by language. I think humans actually have this intuition, mm-hmm. that it is, and this is something, the whole idea of tolerating viewpoint diversity and freedom of speech is the thing that is counterintuitive.
Right. Another principle that you talk about in your book is the postmodern political principle. Yeah, a belief that society is formed around systems of power and hierarchies which decide what can be known and how. And identity politics, they try to dismantle this system in the name of social justice. This seems also very paradox to me, because hierarchies are a part of life, aren't they?
I think so, yes. I mean, there's certainly a criticism that can be made of hierarchies, but I like the book recently written by Nicholas Christakis, which is Blueprint, and that looks at the social suite, how humans make the best societies. And one of the elements of that is a mild hierarchy, and it's a hierarchy formed on meritocracy, not on identity. So where we have a problem with hierarchies, which I think we certainly do, is when we have great class inequality, when we have racial systems which disadvantage non-white people, when women aren't allowed to access power, then we have a hierarchy that's a problem. I don't think hierarchy in itself is naturally a problem if people form into it naturally, if it comes of respect for people having leadership qualities in certain areas. So I think, yeah, I don't like the idea of hierarchy. My soul is socialist, I'm afraid. But I think we have to kind of, whatever works for social justice is going to need to work with human nature and not against it.
Right. You also say that identity politics is always concerned with privilege that a certain group, mostly white, has over another group, mostly a minority, for example, black. So has privilege replaced class, economic class, in this kind of thinking? And what potentially dangerous consequences stem from this replacement?
I think we certainly are seeing less focus on class analysis. There's very little of that now, and much more focus on identity. Mm-hmm. And this is more of a problem, I feel, because it doesn't allow for actually making material change. You know, it's so much a matter of attitudes and biases and trying to spot the power dynamics and unpick them. And then this privilege manifests in so many ways. It's just a recipe for hostility, where what we need is empirical research into things. Are Black people being disadvantaged in certain ways? Is class an issue here? How can we address that? That is the kind of social justice we need.
Mm-hmm. And that's why also the populist right is gaining in power, right? Because they address class issues.
I think that certainly is an element of it. Yes, mm-hmm. I think that the left, having taken on so much of the identity politics approach, has alienated much of the working class, and not only the white working class.
Yeah. You also write about the intersections of activism and education. And so many educators become activists or feel the pressure to become activists. Would you say that activist thought and dynamics are also entering into journalism nowadays?
I certainly see a lot of that. Yes, I think it's even more forgivable in journalism if people are arguing from a... I shall finish my sentence, Raphael.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, if people are arguing explicitly from a political position, not if we're supposed to be representing the information objectively. So the BBC, for example, isn't supposed to take a political side, and it shouldn't do so. However, I do also think part of the marketplace of ideas is people writing from their own political opinions and addressing other ones honestly, ideally.
Okay.
I mean, somebody just pointed out to me that I am essentially an activist in my writing, and I am. I have to admit that, but I'm, I am arguing for liberalism quite openly, and I think there are arguments that need to be made.
Sure. But on the other hand, I mean, like what I perceive, especially on Twitter, is that posts about, for example, how white an editorial office is, and that this has to change to become more diverse. I mean, on the one hand, it makes sense to tell stories from the perspective of a person of color. On the other hand, this kind of addressing of this issue is also alienating, too many people, right?
I think so, yeah. It tends to put people into stereotypical boxes,
right.
And then we get the authentic voice of the Black person, and then other Black people are saying, well, actually, I don't agree with that, and then they're considered to be part of the problem. And it gets a very sort of toxic mess if we have this kind of overt politicization of everything, which is just accepted as true rather than argued for.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this question makes sense, because it's maybe also alienating to me when I see this kind of post where people actually count how many white people are in an editorial office and how many Black people are in an editorial office. And I always think, like, why are you doing this? This doesn't make any sense. Of course, things have to change in order to make offices more diverse in that sense, but it's not leading anywhere to count certain groups of people.
I think there are better and worse ways to try and measure whether everybody has access to everything, and counting the end result is likely to go wrong. So in publishing, as we're talking about right now, there are quite a lot more women than men. This doesn't indicate that there are social pressures in society to keep men out of journalism, out of publishing. There seems to be something to do with women being more verbally motivated on average, having higher communication skills on average. So I think, we have different sexes drawn to different jobs. We also have cultural differences, which aren't always to do with the dominant culture oppressing the minority ones. It's nothing to do with white supremacy that Indian Brits are four times more likely to be doctors than the general population. So there just isn't enough nuance if you're going in at the end and then only looking at the imbalances which fit your narrative, and then claiming to have discovered that white supremacy or patriarchy or something is still very much evident. That's a mess.
Okay. Social justice activism also claims to empower minorities and give them a voice. But is social justice activism and concepts like post-colonialism, that are rooted in postmodern theory, actually beneficial to people living in previously colonized countries, or to people, for example, experiencing racism on a daily basis?
I don't think the social justice approach is almost ever useful. That the good work being done on looking at people's experiences is the empirical work, the materialist scholars, the ones who aren't going by this theory that the invisible power dynamics must exist, but who are looking at what does exist, measuring it in material terms and addressing it. So, for example, Michelle Alexander, I have some disagreements with some of her interpretations, but she and her The New Jim Crow is a really rigorous and empirical look at the data around policing, which will give anybody who wants to know whether the claim that there is a racist element to police action in the US can go to. This is so much better than the theoretical approach, which starts talking about the history of patrols which picked up slavery and how we still have this mindset. And, you know, it's also conjectural and crazy. It really undermines its own cause.
Right. It seems to me that you're also describing this dichotomy of fact-based thinking and emotional thinking somehow.
Yeah, I mean, that we are humans and we need both. So we're often more interested in how people are experiencing things and feeling about things than the actual facts of things. But when it comes to social justice issues, to social engineering, to seeking equality via policy change, we really need to go with the empirical evidence.
Right. You also quote Martin Luther King's famous statement, "I have a dream that my four children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character," which would be outrageous to say in identity politics nowadays. You know, and compared to that idea that white people are racist by default, it's so excluding to people who actually have good intentions to help in race relations. So how come that we are told nowadays that white people are inherently racist and just need to listen?
It comes down to this, what they call standpoint epistemology, where different people have different knowledges according to the group that they are in. And so because the understanding of the dominant discourses with that whole Foucauldian postmodern mess is that white people have dominated the discourses for so long that it now just seems natural, but it's actually a white Western male way of knowing. This means to remedy this, it means that white people, men, other dominant groups need to be quiet and listen to the experiences of marginalized or minoritized groups. Of course, in practice, what happens when you listen to the views of, say, black people is you find out that they differ quite considerably. And then we get into the mess where we decide that some of them are authoritative and some of them aren't. That Martin Luther King quote, that is, there's a lot of pushback against critics of identity politics using that, because people claim that King didn't mean this universal liberal standard. And then they bring out his letter in Birmingham jail where he spoke of white moderates being the worst of the worst. So this is a kind of battle of interpretation of Martin Luther King that goes back and forth between the liberals and the identity politicians.
Let's come to the end of your book. I think that cynical theories is an encomium for liberalism. I mean, is there an alternative to social justice for liberals who are concerned about issues of social justice, actually? A liberalism without identity politics?
Yeah, this is what we are advocating. Yes, we think that social justice issues need to be investigated empirically, rigorously, and on the level of ideas. We need to renormalize the universalism. We need to get rid of the idea that we must focus on identity categories in order to empower minoritized ones, and instead keep doing what the liberal process was of removing that significance. You know, you may be black, you may be a woman, but this should tell us absolutely nothing about what your roles should be in life. You are you. You must have the right to decide that. And anything that gets in the way of you deciding that is something we need to address.
Mm-hmm. And a very astonishing statement in your book is, and I'm quoting it right now, "In liberal societies, we already have the answer to the problem of how to deal with reified philosophical systems that threaten to impose themselves on society. This answer is called secularism." So why that? This is usually like the division between state and church.
Yes, but the principles of secularism were to put boundaries around religious ideologies. They were to protect the right to believe in that ideology, freedom of belief, but not to impose it on anybody else. So there's been an understanding that you may be a Christian, you may believe, for example, that homosexuality is a sin, you may not harass homosexuals about it or force people to listen to your evangelism if they don't want to hear it. So secularism as a broader principle is about freedom of conscience, freedom of belief, about pluralism. We need to all live together. We need to be able to have very strong opinions. If we have them, we need to be able to express them. We must not let any one ideology get the power to dominate over the rest of them. And that's not working very well at the moment. And I think the problem is that critical social justice isn't seen as the same kind of thing as a religion. And so there aren't the boundaries around it for people to be able to say, actually, I don't believe in invisible systems of power and privilege. I don't think I'm racist, or I don't think I experience racism in the way that you say I do. And that's a problem. We need to expand the concept of secularism.
Thank you so much for this interview.
No, it was good talking to you.